Hank Thompson series?
Sure.
Hank Thompson is a bartender. Imagine that. And all of a sudden, the guy across the corridor from him drops off a cat cage. Pretty much all hell breaks loose after that.
Yeah, or as I prefer to say, and this is kind of the fulcrum upon which all of my books lever, turn, whichever, it is the point at which shit gets all fucked up. And it usually comes fairly early in the book. This is the first novel by a guy in his early 30s, and not surprisingly, and playing much to type and form, there's a tremendous amount of autobiography in there. The bartending, the geography of that book was the geography of my everyday life at that point. The apartment that Hank occupies is modeled in my mind on the apartment that I was living in. The bar where he works is the bar that I was working in the West Village, transported to the East Village. It's occupying the location of the bar that I drank in. The movie theater that I used to go to, the park that I used to jog in, everything. There's his girlfriend lives in one of my ex-girlfriend's apartments, all of that kind of stuff. His love of the San Francisco Giants, the town that he's from, all of this kind of stuff gets thrown into the hopper. Where it deviates is murderers and mayhem and all of that kind of stuff. And then initially, in his personality and in his reaction to these things going, I originally, like I said, I thought Hank was going to be something like a PI, and he's going to be a fairly tough guy, but not incredibly tough, because that never, that just didn't work for me. And rather than being that kind of character, he ended up being more of the, more of the Hitchcockian wrong man, fish out of water. And to that extent, the character ended up being more rooted in my own personality as well. And the initial choices that I made were, it wasn't like I was sitting there going, now what would I do? It was more a matter of, well, what can I imagine somebody doing in these circumstances? And, I was the best reference point that I had. So, you're just drawing off of that. And then the further you go from your own personal experiences and the farther you go down the path of shit getting all fucked up, the less you have to go on, and the more the character just deviates from who you are and becomes very much his, his own person.
Well, you kind of know it's not a light-boiled kind of thing as soon as he ends up saying that his neighbor dropped off the fucking cat. And his life went downhill from there.
Yeah.
So,
and this was, just to sidebar on a story of publishing, For the folks who haven't read it, I've made a joking reference to cat torture. It's a scene that takes place in the early, like the first 60, 70 pages of the book. The cat is tortured, and when we did the editing process for the book, Mark was pretty happy. My editor, Mark Cavani, was pretty happy with the whole book. And he said, I am worried about the cat torture. He said, it's so early in the book, and it's so gruesome. I said, I'm really worried about it shutting out a lot of readers before they have a chance to get into the book. So he had this really groovy idea, which I was willing to try because it was a grounded, groovy idea. And his idea was, what if the cat, not only did the cat not get tortured, but what if the cat survives everything? What if, as we go through this, it is the counterpoint is not him protecting the cat, trying to, because the cat has been horribly mutilated. What if the whole point is all these awful things are happening to Hank, but the cat just walks through the room full of bullets, whatever kind of a thing. So I was like, oh, that's an interesting approach. So I said, yeah, let's try and rewrite it there. And you basically just have to rewrite this thread that runs through the book. And of course, there, part of me is, what an interesting problem. The other part of me is like, well, of course I'll do anything you ask me to do because I want this damn job. I want my life to change. And I did it. And he read it and he said, it's not... He said, the relationship has become antagonistic now. I said, well... constantly getting beaten up and mutilated, and the cat is fine. He hates the fucking cat now. He said, no, it's not really working. And I said, I'll try again. You want me to, you know, anything you want. Oh, my tail's wagging when he is, you know. He said, no, we took an honest try at it. It doesn't work. It's better the other way. We'll keep it the other way. And that's what we did. And that kind of ended up, that really kind of defined our process as we've gone through as a team on 11 books now is there are, you know, we talk about things that he thinks may or may not benefit. If it's a major thing, he kind of gives the what he thinks are the philosophical, you know, support or the logistical support for making a major change. I either, you know, counterpoint or give it a shot, and then we talk about whether or not it works. Then if it doesn't work, we usually go back.
So Rick, then you're juggling two series. You have the Hank Tompkins series. You've already started the Joe Pitt series.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, Shotgun Rule. You get a standalone that gets tossed in there. How did you come up with that?
Well, I was wrapping up. I knew we were going to be wrapping up the, you know, there's again, the long answer, you know, you come to a contract. It's time, your contract's up. So the initial two-book contract I'd had for Hank Thompson books was up. By then, I had gotten a contract for Joe Pitt, which had allowed me to stop bartending because at that point I was doing two books a year. And now it was time, well, we know what, on my next crime contract, you know, they want to do a two-book deal. We know the first book is going to be the end of the Hank Thompson trilogy. And he wants to know, what do I want to do after that? Do I have another idea for a series? Do I want to do a standalone? I did not have another idea for a series. I had two or three ideas for standalones. I said, these are my two or three ideas for standalones. He told me that column three was the one he was most interested in. And I said, okay. And then somewhere in there I said, you know, column A is probably what I'm more interested in ultimately. And he said, okay, column A is fine. And that was Shotgun Rule. I think I pitched it to him, literally, and I'm not joking here. I said, group of teenage boys in the Bay Area in the 80s. One of them has their bike stolen. They break into a house to get the bike back, find something they shouldn't find, and shit gets all fucked up. And he said, okay, yeah, we'll go with that. We'll go with that. He didn't know, and this is a real leap of faith for him, because with the Hank Thompson trilogy, he had a whole book. With the Joe Pitt series, he had 100 pages and a series Bible to go off of. With the first standalone, that's literally all I gave him, was those few sentences. And it's all he asked for until he saw it, and that's all he had until he saw the first draft, was it. So that was it. You know, it was time to tell a different kind of story. I had written by then the trilogy and at least two of the Pitt books. They were all first-person present tense. They were all quite hard-boiled, Joe more than Hank. I felt very much that if I didn't try writing something in a different voice and a different style, that it was going to be a problem for me. Because by then I was thinking, wow, this may actually be a career. And it may actually be, you know, I should invest some energy and, you know, effort into this. And not just, you know, go on automatic pilot. Not that any of it was easy, but, you know, I needed to change. So that was a lot of what was going on with Shotgun Rule.
So was one of the columns Mystic Arts, though? Where did that come
from? No, well, it was, to the extent that my original... Yes, it was, actually. One of the original columns was Mystic Arts, but Trauma Cleaning, which is the most identifiable facet of Mystic Arts, just as vampires are the most identifiable facet of Joe Pitt, was years away. What was, to me, Mystic Arts, or what I was toying with, was a very self-aware detective character who was where the humor would be more present than in the Hank or the Joe books, where the tone would be a little bit lighter, and just basically a loose concept for a serious detective. And that was the one that he was most interested in.
Yeah, is it because all the carnage from the first book, somebody had to do cleaning up?
You think I could do a great crossover between Webster and Joe Pitt at some point.
How about that? Are you gonna?
No. If I was ever feeling really wacky and I was bored and I needed to put something on the website, I might do that one day, but that would be it. No, it was the things that were most important to me about Mystic Arts were I wanted a slightly different voice. I wanted to do it past tense so that when you're doing first person present tense, so much of the game is keeping the action moving forward constantly, not falling into the trap of letting your character reflect too much in moments of action and distress, because it breaks the conceit. Especially with the Hank Thompson books, where there's no, you know, he's being debriefed by the police, or there's no DOA kind of, you know, conceit where he's telling this story after the fact. And those books are written, in my mind, they're meant to be his stream of consciousness. And it means that there's no point, there's very few points at which you can let the characters reflect or really say something about what's going on about them, other than in little, you know, one-offs. So I really wanted a character who could, in the middle of action, stop, turn to the reader and say, okay, this jerk over here is a really big jerk, and this is why this person is a jerk, and this is what's going to happen to this jerk later, but right now, this is what I'm dealing with right now. I wanted to have room for those kind of flourishes. I also wanted to be able to, I wanted a character who was very, very verbal. Hank and Joe are not. Hank is a smartass. Joe is a real smartass, but he's also pretty monosyllabic. I wanted a character who had a background and an attitude and a makeup that could really play that way. And lighter, less violent. You see the results of a lot of carnage in Mystic Arts, but there isn't a lot of carnage happening on the page. And after writing those books, yes, someone needed to clean up. You know, I needed a break. I needed someone to come in and clean up and give me a break from the kind of relentless darkness and violence.
Well, being, you know, on the little more humorous undertone kind of thing too, and so it's kind of comic relief in a way.
For me, in my life, it definitely played that way. It was a huge breath. In terms of the personal relationships, I think it may be darker than anything predating it, because his relationships with his family and the people around him are so effed up. But in terms of that real, you know, the brutality, much lighter, much easier on me. I needed to inhale.
Yeah. So other stuff that you end up doing, I mean, you're in. You talked about short stories. You know, about basically Hank starting as a short story, mm-hmm. that just kind of expanded for the most
metastasized.
Part. Yeah. good word. I like that. In graphic novels, how do you balance all that in there? And
to be just slightly technical or pedantic or whatever about it. I don't write graphic novels. Graphic novels theoretically are, you know, you sit down, you write a whole conceived story, blah, blah, blah. I've written serialized comic books that have been, you know, I'm a comic book writer, not a graphic novelist. It was random. Again, I've characterized my career in the past as someone who's a blind drunk, wandering through a field full of cow shit and always stepping on the green grass for no good reason whatsoever, mm-hmm. with no, just unjust, unfair, just always getting lucky. And this was kind of another case of this. Marvel Comics was trolling for writers. They just had Gilnet out. They had never heard of me. There was a query letter that went into my agency looking for novelists who were interested in writing licensed novels using their characters. And I had no interest in writing, you know, the Wolverine novelization of the comic book. You know, just sounded, A, it was tedious, B, I was writing my own novels, why would I do that? But the idea, I had been a big comic book fan when I was a kid, so the idea of writing a comic book sounded cool. So I was like, well, what if? And they said, well, if you want to write a comic book, then you're going to have to show us some damn credentials. So, you know, we sent them a couple books, and they read them, and they liked them, and then there's a whole you know, you would think that you were trying to get into the Emerald City. You know, I mean, the paperwork you have to go through just to have a serious conversation with an editor at Marvel Comics about doing something, because I guess in the past there, you know, because of the ownership of the characters is so clear, because there have been conflicts in the past about who had the idea for what story, you basically have to sign away, you know, all these rights before you can sit down and talk, so that if a story, they print a story in the future that's similar to anything you've talked to them about, you know, they don't, you can't hold them accountable if you think it's theirs, whatever. Anyway, after a lot of that kind of BS, once we actually sat down and talked, it was a fairly short series of conversations where we mentioned characters, and somebody said, hey, have you ever heard of this guy Moon Knight, who's this bizarre, obscure 70s character that only someone like me would have been obsessed by when they were 13 years old, as I was. And so in another, you know, stepping on another patch of green grass between the cow patties, not only do I end up writing a comic book, I end up writing a comic book about a character that I had loved when I was, again, 13, 14 years old. So that's how that started. And then it went, it basically the short, beyond that, it's just, it went well. I was good at it. I had a great relationship with my editor. So when I've needed other opportunities or wanted other opportunities, I've been able to pursue it.
Well, we talked about this earlier, you know, at lunch. It kind of took me by surprise, and someone came up and ended up saying, you know, when did his first book come out? And I'm going, 2004, but there's, you know, there's what, 11 books that are over there?
10 books over here and one more coming out in January.
Yeah, so that's a lot of writing within a short period of time, you know, when a lot of people are just struggling to try to put one out a year, or one every 2 years.
Well, there's a couple things, you know, there's a couple things that work there. And we're, the other thing Bobby and I were talking about, I'm on a kind of a hiatus going on right now. For the first time, I don't have a book that I'm under contract to for the first time since this period started in my life. And so I'm kind of enjoying that and also in terror. Fortunately, I've got other work that's lined up perfectly with this pause, so I'm not in terror about finances. But it is kind of weird to have worked very intently, nonstop for almost 6 years on one area of work, and to all of a sudden not, you know, you're like, at first you're like, oh, this is nice, and then you're like, wait, where's the ground? Where's the, you know? But I was cataloging it in my sleep, so it's Cop Stealing was done. So it was 10 books since 2004. It's actually 2003 to be technical, because I wrote Six Bad Things by 2003. So let's call it 6 years. So 10 books. The comic book scripts that I wrote in that time basically are the equivalent to two or three screenplays. Two more screenplays, a few short stories, and then several hundred thousand words of interviews, website, that kind of stuff. So another couple of novels worth of what have you. What was shocking to me about that, the other thing that I should say in this is, I write short novels with low word counts. So my novels generally park in between 240 and 280 pages, and we usually scrape around 80,000 words, which for that kind of page count isn't a lot of words, because I have a lot of dialogue and I have a lot of very short sentences and very short paragraphs. So I cheat a little bit. It's not a conscious thing, it's just my natural style. So a couple things. One, the way I write lends itself towards producing a lot of books that aren't very dense. The other thing is that I got so lucky with selling the Joe Pitt series just before Cop Stealing had published. And this put me in a position, and because at that point my wife was working full time and was well employed, and we had a low rent, it's all these things that go into the hopper that let you do this. So I found myself in a situation where the nut wasn't that big. My wife is a sport. I was bringing in enough money off of a small book contract to cover my end. And there was no choice. It was you can write full time, or you can and make money writing full time, or you can write not at all. Was basically it. You can write 2 books a year and make just enough, or you know, not. So I could only support us. Eventually, it came to the point where I was supporting both of us, but I could only support both of us by writing 2 books a year. And fortunately, and I was in a situation where I had 2 books. So you just, you know, at that point, it's you just work.
Yeah.
You know, you just work. And the thing that's most shocking to me is I am profoundly lazy. I'm a deeply, deeply, deeply lazy man. I have to go home after this and work, and all I want to do is plop down at that bar with 5 more Irish coffees and watch some football. And I don't know, I feel like I'm doing nothing. I feel like, frankly, it's not that I feel like it. I left 2 books on the field during that period of time. I could have written 2 more books during that time if I had really, or a couple more screenplays or a bunch more comic books or something. I could have, I left something out there on the field that I could have picked up. And that's what I kick myself over, is if I had really put the pedal down, I could have done more. I'm lazy. So when there was a gap, and I could have kept working, I, you know, took advantage of it. And the truth is, the truth is, if I had actually tried to work during those periods, the product probably would have been miserable, or one of the other books would have been miserable, because my brain wouldn't have had a chance to recover.
Yeah, I mean, I'm more prone to, if I end up getting a book, you know, if it's huge, I don't read more than 350-page book. And I'm actually tending toward stories and novellas now.
Right.
Just, and it's kind of like, you know, screenplay people that start writing, Jesse Kellerman being one, got it down that it's dialogue, it's, you know, it's compacted, it's, you know, you get a lot in
right.
there in a shorter period of time. You don't need all that extra stuff that happens to go in there. So I don't know, I like them better.
I don't. I've been asked a lot about, you know, why, because there is a very, there's a cinematic style that both in terms of the books being, you know, action dialogue. So literally cinematic in that they paint pictures and create sound, and then but also cinematic in that they in terms of format, there's something very much like screenplay to the way the books are written. And I've been asked about that. I think part of it is symptomatic of the kinds of stuff that I like to read, which tends to get to the meat of the matter. I think it also, part of it comes out of the acting background, from having read a crud load of plays more than screenplays. And particularly having read, you know, it's you know, one of the ironies of my life is I'm a classically trained actor, so I studied freaking Shakespeare from here to, you know, the end of the universe. And you know, when you're reading old theater, you know, whether it's Shakespeare or Moliere or, you know, Aeschylus, whatever, there's no stage directions, you know, except for exit off, and there's no anything to indicate what the character is feeling, or you just get the dialogue and you've got to extrapolate action and emotion and intention and all that from the dialogue. And so I think that there's a part of me that loves that. That doesn't. I like to write blocks of dialogue that have little lines of character actions. He picks up the glasses, line of dialogue. He puts glasses down, line of dialogue. Where the little actions in between the dialogue, or the way the sentence is punctuated, are meant to indicate emotion or sensibility, as opposed to having the narrator, whether it's the character themselves or a third person, say, you know, what the character is doing. And if you spend a lot of time describing the interior life of the character, you can consume a lot of freaking pages on that. You know, you can fill a lot of text on that. Have you, you were talking about the kind of books you want to read. Has anybody added up how many more books they're going to read the rest of their life? Has anybody else engaged in this exercise in don't do it? Now I've planted the seed. I kind of figured out how many novels, because the only time I read nonfiction is if I'm researching. I kind of figured out how many books a month you know, I read these days. I actually have time for it. It's a very, very small number. And then I went, well, I'm 42. I might live another X number of years. I did some multiplication. I was like, oh, my God, I have to read less crap. I have to, you know, it's time to go to the Penguin section to get all the classics, all the stuff that I should have been. That'll get you reading some short books in a hurry. And so that'll, you know, you'll look at the next doorstop, unless you're a real fast reader, and you'll be like, I don't know, I could get like 3 in there in the time it'll take me to do that.
Yeah. Well, the interesting thing is,
Why don't we take a couple questions?
Okay, sure. That'll be good. Oh, one quick thing though. Audiobooks and Kindle.
Yeah.
When I was at BoucherCon this year, BoucherCon being a fan-based mystery author convention, at breakfast, you know, the tables being at a premium, somebody sat down, and it was just a woman, young woman from Atlanta, who'd end up saying, found out I was a bookseller, and ended up saying, okay, well, you know, here's the deal. I'm probably saying something, you know, nasty, but how do you feel about Kindle? And I said, if it gets people to read, it's a cheap enough medium, and if it gets them to read and it gets them to end up reading a lot of different people, then it's a really good thing. You know, yeah, it cuts into my sales, but it might not ultimately. Because what's going to happen is some of you people are going to end up saying, well, we don't know where to turn, and you end up turning to us, and you'll end up coming in, or you're looking for something special. And she loved it and ended up saying that before she would end up reading 3 books a year, and she's read 80 books so far this year. So, because of Kindle, because she bought a Kindle.
80.
So, are your books on Kindle?
Hell yeah, my books are on Kindle, and I'm a big fan of that stuff. I don't own one myself because I don't read enough for it to be in any way kind of practical to my life. If I traveled more, if I read more, if I was a professional reader like an editor or an agent or, you know, something like that, they all love them. It would make a lot more sense, but it doesn't. I have 3 books out there. Look, hey. Sorry, Bobby. The Scribd website hosts the entire Hank Thompson trilogy. You open a Scribd account, all that takes, you set up a password, give them your email address. You never get any crap email, never get any spam through them. You can download those things as a PDF and put them, and you can print them if you want to, you know, and they're there for free. And I've got the link to it right on my website, because absolutely. And it's all anecdotal, and you're not going to hear from someone who read part of your book for free and then never was interested in any of your other books. So it's a self-selecting sample. But I get quite a few emails from people that said, I got the free book when it was on. We had them on sample for free on Amazon. And there's another reader called Stanza, and the whole trilogy for a while was a free. If you downloaded Stanza, you got the whole trilogy with that. Who said, I read them, the free ones, and I've started buying the books since then. Mm-hmm. It's going to happen, whether we want it to happen or not. The question is, are you going to be there to meet it, you know, and are you going to embrace it and find your place within it, or are you just, you know, we can fight and howl in the wilderness all we want to, but it's happening. It's just a matter of trying to make it as advantageous as possible for everyone. Ultimately, more people are going to read, I think, which I love, is part of the reason why I'm a fan of giving away the books for free, because I don't, I'm not anywhere close to some threshold where 100 more books is going to suddenly change my life or anything like that. And I'd rather the books are just being read, period, than anything else. That's kind of where I am on it.
Yeah, I think it comes full circle. Like you end up saying, you know, somebody ends up reading it, but they'll end up buying the book for a present for someone else. You know?
So let's do a couple questions before we run out of time.
Well, you've been talking about your blog, you've been talking about Kindle. What other kind of marketing do you do that?
Active?
Yeah.
Nobody knows. Seriously, nobody knows. I mean, marketing and publicity is a huge, you know, advertising, that's a huge mystery out there. And you can sit down in a room full of professional ad people and the theories, and, you know, it is behavioral psychology, philosophy, astrophysics, it's, you know, metaphysics rather. It's a whole thing. And in the book business, really nobody knows. And the best that anybody can tell you is the most time-tested way to sell a lot of books is to print a lot of books, so that they're out there when people walk into bookstores, highly visible there for the people who actually buy books, for the people who actually walk into bookstores and browse them. What do I do? Airports. What do I do? I fought the power. I didn't want to have a website, but my first book tanked really hard, and I needed, I needed to help. I needed to help the effort. So I did the website. My philosophy was, I don't want a website that's a bulletin board. I want a website that's a medium, not for interaction, because it's tough, I'm working, but someplace where I could add something so there'd be more to access if people wanted it. I go to the bookstore, I do the bookstore tour. I know a lot of writers who are really invested in putting themselves out on tour. I don't know who has the time, I don't know the money to send themselves out on tour. I go on the tour that my publisher sends me out, which is a handful of cities. I don't know how much it helps. Frankly, I think the most effective thing that I do marketing-wise is when I go to the bookstores is meeting the booksellers. Because they may like your book, but if you like each other, that's always going to help with hand.
And it's actually huge. I mean, I can end up saying that an author, before their first book happens to be published, checking in with the independent bookstores. And I was talking about this at VoucherCon with a bunch of new authors. Make sure that they get an advanced reader's copy that comes out if you have a book that's being published. Call them up and end up asking them, did you end up getting the advanced reader's copy? If you didn't, try to get them one so that they at least know, number one, that you're interested in their store, and two, that they remember your name and they probably remember the title of your book. And they're more apt to end up picking it up and reading it when you do something like that.
So what's the difference between the elements that you found there between the Raymond Chandler era of noir and contemporary noir? I mean, are there some primary things that you differ?
The really easy answer is I don't know. It would be very hard for me to. I don't read a ton of crime. I could very easily have been hip deep in boxing novels and wanted to write a boxing short story that turned into a boxing novel that never got sold. I just happened to be on a crime spree with this window of my life. So I would say that the classic era of noir, I would say, was largely was perhaps more heartfelt and had, even though one of the underpinnings of noir is moral ambiguity, the character, your leads tend to have more of a moral center, the Chandler, the good man within this world, and that is maybe less, and as with, the age of irony, whatever, contemporary noir tends to be more self-aware. So you get the term neo-noir, which doesn't necessarily just imply that it's a contemporary setting, but an attitude that's a little bit more, not necessarily self-mocking, but plays with conventions a little bit. That's probably the best I could do.
Did you get any flack from readers about the cat?
Not really. I think that anybody who's real. I mean, I've had some people. I've had a lot of people tell me how disturbing they found it. I think anybody who is really offended, messed up by it, whatever like that, they put the book down and or they knew that I wasn't the kind of person they wanted to interact with. And I think that generally tends to be the case. Negative. The audience that you hear from as a writer, I think, tends to be very self-selecting. It's usually the people who wish you well and who are really enthusiastic about it. It's very rare that I get direct communication from somebody who wants to tell me how much they think I suck or how foul my language is or how the violence is too much or whatever, and sometimes they actually have a question or a point to make, in which case I respond, and sometimes they just want to get it off their chest, in which case it's probably better for me just to stay quiet. What's part two?
Well, that's a comment on that. That's interesting because I had in the bad guy had two the dog was fine. You know, just I got a couple of liked your book, but you have to be cruel to animals, you know. So I found it really interesting because I think it was relatively mild.
But that may have also been part of it. I think, you know, maybe, you know, people probably finished your book after the dog got thrown against the wall. I think there were probably a lot, as soon as the cat's leg was broken, etc., I think that a lot of people, you know, the people who really are more disturbed by a cat being tortured as opposed to the guy who's having his surgical staples ripped out at the same time, they probably closed the book, you know. And this is one of the great mysteries of human nature and life, that will, in our fiction anyway, tolerate all these horrible things happening to, you know, to people, but God forbid you throw a dog against the wall.
Well, my second question is the shotgun rule. I love and the character is so colorful, and like especially I remember the guy who sat on the couch and he was drinking crap.
Yeah.
So, was that a lot from your
childhood? Yeah, well, that character, no. Geezer was—he was pretty much whole cloth. The town that story takes place in is nameless, but it's based on the town I grew up in. And there's a lot of compositing going on with the boys, in particular, of assorted kids that I ran with. Some of the adults, same thing. The level of chaos and mayhem exceeds the level of chaos and mayhem that I was involved in. I was a peripheral kind of. I either had too much common sense or lacked the balls or whatever it was that you needed to cross a certain line. But up to the point where that line was crossed, those were the people that I was hanging out with. And then when they came back across the line, I was, you know, hearing about what was happening over on that side of the line and doing plenty of other things over here. So there was a lot in that book that, you know, was... and that's part of a lot of the reason why that was the book that I wanted to write when I came to that point in my writing, where there was a reason why it was that specific story that I wanted to tell. I wanted to write about some people I knew. I wanted to write about some relationships that I had had. And I don't know why. Just because.
Oh, nameless.
What are you reading that you're excited by?
Can we do this one? And then we'll cut. I just finished Don DeLillo's Falling Man, which I really liked. Not my favorite of his. But, I'm sorry?
Jewish?
It should just be out in trade paper. I think it was 2007. It should be out in trade paperback. I'm just started last night Jeff Vandermeer's Finch. I knew nothing about this guy. He's mostly a science fiction writer, I guess. This is the third or fourth book in a series called the Ambergris series, but they're not connected. It's just the world that they're set in, and it's a weird... Richard K. Morgan describes it as fungal noir. So it's definitely a detective story set in a fantasy, sci-fi kind of thing. I just picked it up, read the first page, liked it. And I've been dipping in and out of William T. Bowman's anthology called The Atlas, which is just like little snippets of journalism and short stories and whatnot, hundreds of them, literally. Anywhere from that long to 5 or 10 pages long.
And what writers do you recommend?
Don DeLillo. I'm in crime specifically. I'm a big James Ellroy fan. Chandler, Hammett. These are going to be older names. We were just talking about Ellroy. Thank you. It's a short list, you know. It's a short list. In general, those guys, Bukowski, I love I'm trying to picture my bookshelf in my mind now, and I'm blanking out. I love William Gibson. I love some of Hemingway. Some of Hemingway really drives me up a wall. For great, like my romance novels are Alan First's World War II espionage novels. That's my vacation reading always.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Our little raffle. If you didn't get a ticket, too bad. That's the way it goes sometimes.
So I love you.
Wait, hold on one second. So the winner, okay, I'm wearing this t-shirt, Bowling for Boobies, because this was this was a fundraiser for breast cancer that actually our sister organization, Sisters in Crime, helped them. They put a team together. And they had these great goodies, so I put some of the goodies in this black box. There's a little hole in there, so you could take, you could put small animals in there later. But Charlie, why don't you...
Claire.
Claire! No, okay, got it.
Joy.
So this is what you had. This is in keeping with our event today. You get a monster drink, energy drink. You get a Bloodlines little book of vampires.
Okay.
You get something for your drink. I don't know, some timer. And then you get a bunch of these comic books. Buffy the Vampire Slayer, The Simpsons, Easter Burden, and Angel. And then you get a Superman and, I don't know, who is this? Is it Supergirl? I don't know who this is. But anyway, you get a t-shirt. So those are your prizes. So enjoy, Joy. And, okay.
No.
Great. So here you go, Jack. And please, we're going to try to stay and sign some books here.
Sure. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I'm going to take a quick break and then I'll come right back.
Jeez, I wanted that box.
Thank you so much for all of your good advice.